Let's start with the facts this morning. Current research shows that it currently takes 4 Christian adults just to get one faithful Christian into the next generation. Now, I'm going to restate that just to make sure everybody understands what I'm saying. According to the most recent research I've seen, it takes 4 adult Christians just to get one faithful Christian into the next generation. You know, there are a lot of preachers who, when they get up to speak, they take a long time finally basically making their point. They do what I call circling the runway. Well, this morning I'm just going to land the plane because we don't have enough time, folks. And here is the bottom line. If you really are honest with yourself and you think about where we are today, you think about that statistic, folks, I think if we're honest with ourselves, Satan's got our children in his hands. And the bottom line is we're doing very, very little about it. Now, I know in the church the knee-jerk reaction to that is, no, not my children or not within this church. Surely not. And friends, let me share with you why I would say something like that. Just a couple of short months ago, we did a survey. 300 teenagers online. It was a Facebook survey. It was anonymous because we wanted them to share the truth with us. We didn't want them thinking, you know, they're going to tell my mom or dad. Out of this particular survey, roughly 97% identified themselves as New Testament Christians. They were our kids. So let me share with you very quickly just some of the results of this survey. For instance, 39% of our kids have viewed internet pornography in recent months. 39%. But notice this, folks. That doesn't say 39% have viewed pornography, because that number would be much, much higher. This is just within recent months. 38% admitted to having cheated in school in the past few weeks. You know, some of you might look at that and you say, well, you know, what's the big deal? It's just a test. Folks, at what point do we, as faithful Christians, condone lying? You know, at what point do we allow our children to think that it's okay to slip into the world? 52% of our kids, I touched this on this Friday night, 52% of our children responded that they believed it would be acceptable to end somebody's life. Euthanasia. Now, folks, that really ought to chill you to the bone. To think about the fact that one day these are going to be the same young people who are deciding whether or not to pull your own plug. Do you think the topic of ethics is important? Well, we're not done yet. 36% of our kids believe that homosexuality is just an alternative lifestyle. Now think about that for just a moment. I'm here to tell you this morning, I believe the world is doing a better job influencing our children than we are in many cases. If this one wasn't bad enough, the next one blew my mind. 43% of our kids indicated that homosexuals ought to have the right to marry. Now, folks, at what point did we forget that that's an abomination to God? You know, to me, when you look at things from an ethical perspective, there really are some black and whites. And this would be one of those. Last but not least, and this ought to be a wake-up call to everybody in this room, 35% of our kids believe that abortion should be legal. Now, what I want you to do for just a moment is I want you to basically put those numbers on the back burner and kind of let it all marinate for just a moment. And I want us to look at one other fact that hopefully is going to help this all come together. Right now, the current fertility rate in the United States of America is sitting at 2.08. And by that I mean 2.08 per family. Now, if you look at the chart behind me, you'll notice the top line is sitting at 2.15. The reason being, in order for a country to basically stay at the same population level, you've got to have a fertility rate of 2.15. In other words, at 2.15, you are replacing the same number of people that's dying. You're not growing, you're basically staying stagnant. So if you look at this, you know, from a purely logistical standpoint, the United States of America, if you really think about it, we're dying. In fact, those of you who watch the news, you know this 2.08 number, it's actually dipped just below 2 now because of the recession. Now, what does that mean? That means realistically, families are only having 2 children. Folks, let me throw this out just for you to chew on. The Muslims, they are having 6 children per family, and they're retaining 95% of their kids. Now think about that for just a minute. 6 children, they're retaining 95%. Do you realize in France and Italy, the birth rate? Well, for France, it's about 1.4. For Italy, it's actually 0.9. Meaning they're only having 1 child per family. And you realize they've had an influx of Muslims over there. 6 children, 95% retention rate. Do you realize that within one generation, France will be a Muslim country, if by nothing else than just population? Now, bring those numbers that we talked about on the back burner. Let's bring them forward and put all this together for just a minute. You remember I told you it takes 4 adult Christians just to get 1 faithful one into the next generation. So let's look for just a minute. We've got generation 1. We're going to say that's everybody in this room. Now, in order for you to get somebody in that next generation, we've got to drop out 3 of those in generation 2. Now, here's the interesting part. We use the most current numbers we've got within the church. 21st Century Christian puts out a directory about every other year. And according to their directory, in the year 2009, there was 1.2 million members of the church. 1.2 million. Now, I do want you to notice one little interesting fact right here. If you look at 2006, folks, we've already lost 40,000. So what I'm telling you is already bearing out in the numbers. But let's be generous. Let's say we're 1.2 million and every single family is having 2 children. But we're only retaining 25%. That means generation 1, right now we've got 1.2 million. Generation 2, we drop down to just 302,000. Generation 3, we're at 75,000. Is that a wake-up call to you this morning? You see, I think part of the problem is this, folks. We are spending more money than we've ever spent in the church on all kinds of weird programs. We're spending all kinds of money on various things, trying basically to trickle people into our bucket. All the while, we've got a hole in the bottom of this bucket. And the hole at the bottom of the bucket is bigger than what we're putting in the top. And the reason that I point this out is, folks, it's time we plug the hole. It is time that we teach our families about religious matters. It is time that they learn about Christian evidences. It's time they learn that the Bible is inspired. It's time they learn about ethics. I mean, when our own kids believe that abortion is okay, when our own children think that homosexuals should have the right to marry, or when more than half of our kids think it's all right to end somebody's life, it tells me we need to do a better job of teaching in these areas. So let's look this morning at some ethics that we haven't covered together. We'll go all the way back to the mid-1800s when a gentleman by the name of Ernst Haeckel changed our view of human life a little bit. Ernst Haeckel said his turning point in his thinking was when he read Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. In fact, those of you who really know history, you know that this guy physically visited Charles Darwin at his home there on the Mount. They discussed their ideas back and forth. Ernst Haeckel, a biologist, came up with some sketches, some drawings. And those drawings basically are meant to support this idea that we've evolved. In fact, let me show you just a couple of them very quickly. Here's another one showing a dog and a human. There's the one that I'm looking for. Very, very well known in most of the textbooks. In fact, let me show you exactly how to read this particular drawing. If you start in the bottom left, you got a fish, a salamander, a turtle, a chicken, a pig, a couple of mammals, and finally a human at three different growth stages. So this would be very, very early on, just a few short weeks, and then a few weeks later, and a few weeks after that. If you'll look across the top row, you're going to notice most all of those animals, whether it's a fish or a man, they all basically look the same. And that was on purpose. Because you see, Ernst Haeckel believed that we all evolved from a common ancestor. The problem is, folks, he actually faked his drawings. Completely lied. In fact, this is a guy who about 150 years ago, he gets kicked out of the University of Jena for forging his pictures. There's his pictures across the top row. What you see on the bottom row is the real McCoy. But folks, here's the problem. We are still using his images today. Now, we've colorized them in a lot of instances. But the point is this. This guy lied in order to basically support the idea, hey, we all evolved from a common creature. In fact, your kids will see things like this in their textbooks talking about us having an evolutionary tail or maybe having gill slits. Very common. This one talks about the tail and the gill pouches of a human being. This is a biology book put out by Arms and Camp. Look very carefully at what they're teaching our kids. It says, by the 7th month, the fetus looks from the outside like a tiny normal baby. But it's not. Friends, why in the world would we teach our children that a 7-month-old growing in the womb is not a human child? Furthermore, let me show you what I consider to be the evil of marketing. Take a look at the picture that's associated with that word or that phrase. Folks, any lady in this room that has ever given birth will quickly tell you that's not a 7-month-old up there. Because by 7 months in the womb, they've got arms and legs. They're doing aerobics. And yet, here's the thing. If they can make our kids associate that picture with that phrase, it makes it a whole lot easier to abort, doesn't it? In fact, it makes it where it doesn't even appear human. Have we seen that in history? Well, let's go back all the way to 1936 when the German Supreme Court refused to recognize Jews living in Germany as persons in the legal sense. I don't know how many of you actually studied the history of that particular era, that war. I spent a great deal of time personally studying it about 2 years ago. One of the things that really woke me up was the fact that they didn't immediately jump out and try to say, hey, that Jews were evil and wrong and bad. You know how they did it? They went through the physicians. They got the doctors on board first. They got the doctors on board with young people and elderly people first. Basically using this idea that they were useless eaters, that there were some lives that didn't deserve to live. From that, they were able to then tweak their thinking into the fact that, hey, there are certain races that are better. And because of that mentality, they began to extinguish the Jews. And folks, if you've never looked at the history, they killed quite literally millions of them. Now, as you think about that, let's move forward to the year 2010, and let's look at our own ethical standard. Where are we today when it comes to, let's start with the beginnings of life, and then let's turn our attention to the end of life. We go to 1959. A couple of decades past this particular declaration by the German Supreme Court. We've got a fellow by the name of Petrucci who says that he had fertilized a human egg that grew outside the body for 59 days. What's the big deal? Folks, in 1959, we didn't know anything about test tube babies. We didn't know anything about artificial insemination. We didn't know any of that. This was a huge deal. He claimed that a heartbeat was discernible, but he destroyed it because he said it became a deformed and enlarged, a monstrosity, he said. That was in 1959. 66, just 7 years later, Russian scientists announced to the unsuspecting world they had succeeded in keeping more than 250 human embryos alive in a laboratory setting for a period of up to 6 months. They didn't show any proof for that, but they did make that claim. We then moved to 1974. 1974, Douglas Beavis announced to the world that he had successfully produced three infants through in vitro fertilization. However, he never actually produced the children, so again, the world is kind of in a lurch. Has anybody really been able to do anything outside of the womb? 1978, all the questions were answered. Because in 1978, a young lady by the name of Louise was born. She was the very first test tube baby that was verified. That was in 1978. Now, the reason I'm throwing all these dates at you is because I want you to realize a lot of the stuff we're talking about today has happened within your lifetime. 1978, Louise Brown became the first test tube baby. The Bourne Hall Clinic, Cambridgeshire, England, has produced about a tenth of the world's test tube babies since that time. Okay, can we do this? Absolutely. Now let's ask the question, should we do this? You see, there are different types or different times where genetic engineering can occur. But folks, just because we can do something doesn't mean we necessarily should do something. So let's look, for instance, at genetic engineering at conception. It is definitely available today. In fact, if I were to make a guess this morning, I suspect that more than half of the congregation in here knows of maybe a family member, an extended family member, a friend, a neighbor, a coworker, who has used some form of fertility treatments in trying to have a child. Okay, so let's ask the question first, should we? What should we do? What is the normal routine? First thing that's going to happen, if you go and you go to a doctor and they say, hey, you know, you're having trouble, what we're going to do is we're going to test both the male and the female. And they are probably going to start out by using fertility drugs. In fact, many of you know people who are on fertility drugs. Basically, those fertility drugs are trying to do two things. Number one, they are trying to help a lady release lots of eggs. And number two, they're trying to make sperm healthier and more motile. Anything wrong with those? Does it involve the destruction of human life in any way? No. So we're okay right there. But what happens when we cross the line and we hit something like maybe an artificial insemination? What's that entail? Artificial insemination is basically where it's a method where they take sperm from a man, egg out of a woman, they fertilize that. It can be done either in glass or inside the lady. You look at that and you say, okay, is that acceptable? Well, let's look for just a second. There's three different designations that I want you to remember, and I hope you will kind of just tuck these back in your mind. There's AIH, which is artificial insemination, using the husband's spermatozoa. Problem with that? Nope. Have you broke the marriage bed in any way? Nope. What about AID? That would be the designation given to artificial insemination using donor's spermatozoa. Now we got a problem. Because all of a sudden we've introduced a third party into that marriage bed, so to speak. And folks, we talked a little bit about Hagar and Ishmael. The third designation is AIDH, which is where you use a combination. And basically the doctor is hoping that the true husband sperm is going to reach there first. Now, out of those three, from a biblical perspective, only the first one is acceptable. Because only the first one keeps that marriage bed pure. So as a faithful Christian, living in the year 2010, living in an area like Flatwoods, Kentucky, let's say your child, your grandchild, your coworker is having trouble. Are they able to use this particular method? Yeah, as long as they use the first method. Any problem with it? No. So if you think about this from a step-by-step procedure, first thing the physician is going to try is usually fertility drugs. If that doesn't work, we go to plan B. What if plan B doesn't work? Before we go there, let me talk for just a second. What are the implications of artificial insemination? Number one, women can bear children for unmarried men. Number two, women could bear children for homosexual men. They could bear children for other couples, i.e. surrogate parenting or surrogate motherhood. Women who are lesbians could have children without marrying. The sex of the child could be pre-selected since it's possible to concentrate the Y chromosomes. In other words, Y chromosomes actually weigh less. What they'll do is they'll put it in a centrifuge. The ones that go to the bottom are actually girls. The ones that stay at the top are boys. Last but not least, legal problems arise as in who is the actual father? Is it the donor? Or is it the legal husband? You know, the other day we talked a little bit about stem cell and cloning, and I said, anytime science hands you a new technology, we got to ask the questions, what are the implications? And folks, there are implications, are there not? We look at the next step. Physician says, okay, that particular process didn't work with you. But we got another process that we think will. It's a process called in vitro or in glass fertilization. So what they do is they take out multiple eggs, they fertilize all of those. And yet, here's the problem. We don't have the laws surrounding this thing the way we should. And because of that, it's really hard to figure out what is the exact success rate of this procedure. Again, I spent a long time doing some research on it. Here are the numbers that I actually came up with. Data released in 1988 indicated that the chance of becoming pregnant after a successful in vitro fertilization was 17%. 17% is not great odds. You throw in the risk of miscarriage or stillbirth, and now we're down to only 11%. 11% success rate, and then you add to it, these things are costing, and those numbers are actually a little bit low. Basically, you can put in right here in the front of your mind, if you're going to try one cycle of this, it's roughly about 10 grand. Do you think one cycle is going to get the job done? No, most people average about three cycles. So now you're into it for about $30,000 and only 11% chance. But folks, remember what we talked about Friday night? You've got a bunch of leftover embryos. You see, when they harvested those embryos or the eggs the first time, they take 15, 18 of them, they fertilize all of them, they select the best three, they implant those. All of a sudden, we've got a problem. Because they're freezing in liquid nitrogen the leftovers. So what do? You see, friends, the problem is we've got too many Christian families that are going to websites. And they are being made all kinds of promises. They're being told that yes, we can get you that baby that you're so longing for. But again, Friends, let me just ask you this question. If we can do something, should we do something? Here's a little test for you to take away from this. If you or somebody you know is in this particular situation, here's what I'd like for you to do mentally. I want you to take about an hour of your time, and I want you to mentally go away to an island. I realize some of you would like to physically go to an island, but this morning I just want you to mentally go there. I want you to be on that island, and the only thing that you've got is your family, enough food to survive, and a Bible. And I want you to think about sitting on that island for about 3 months, digesting God's Word. And folks, by the way, if you've never done this, and I mean mentally done this, physically find a spot maybe in your office, in your home, where for about 3 months you can do nothing but dive in and try to get rid of all the worldly influences, all of the things your friends are saying, everything your coworkers are saying, and just use God's Word as your guide. Friends, you're going to find out exactly what you need to do, whether it be in what we're talking about this morning, whether it be talking about end-of-life decisions, whether it be talking about how you treat your spouse, whether it's talking about how you treat your parents. So you go away to that island to discern precisely what you should do. Because folks, once we open up this can of worms with these fertility practices, it gets awfully confusing. Let me share just one case with you. Pat Anthony, 48-year-old grandmother, became a surrogate mom for her daughter. Now, not only did she give birth to her grandchild, folks, she actually had triplets. Now, think about this for just a moment. Daughter and son-in-law were unable to have children together. So they created a healthy embryo that was then implanted into her mom, who then has triplets. So this is the first time in human history that you've got a grandmother who's giving birth to her grandchildren. Talk about some crazy legal problems. What would happen if that grandmom wanted to keep those children? What are the implications of this one? They are long, they are vast, but let me just throw a couple at you. Number one, women who desired to have children, but whose health wouldn't permit it, could donate an egg, have it fertilized through in vitro fertilization, hire a surrogate mother. And folks, we're seeing that in Hollywood all the time. We got ladies who are in their 40s who decide, you know what? I think it would be fashionable or cool or trendy to have children. Now, they're not having them because they view them as a blessing from God, and they would like to basically be homemakers and do what the Bible talks about. No, it's because it's basically like another fashion accessory. Number two, older women who wish to avoid the threat of genetic diseases common with their age group, they could accept a fertilized egg from a young woman donor, carry it to term in their own womb. So now we've got mixtures going back and forth. Women who could rent their wombs, i.e. surrogate motherhood, and be paid for it. And so now you've got money even entering into the picture of all of this. So when you look at preconception ethics, folks, Christians need to realize we can't violate the marriage bed. And number two, we most certainly cannot destroy life. Now, I put up on the screen that there are different times when genetic engineering can occur. I want to take just a moment of your time and look at that last one. What about postnatally? What about after birth? Do we have manipulation after birth? Well, let's see. Joan Hodgman, a doctor, she said, if we have a baby that I know is malformed beyond hope, I make no attempt to preserve its life. Remember I told you Friday about the little room? Here's some people who believe in that little room. This is from Richard McCormick. He said, life is a value to be preserved only in a so far as it contains some potentiality for human relationships. In other words, I'm now going to be the judge as to whether this child should live or die. Sir Francis Crick said, no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment. And if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to live. So in other words, if you don't live up to our standard, we don't believe that you should live. William Galen said, it used to be easy to know what we wanted for our children, and now the best for our children might mean deciding which ones to kill. We've always wanted the best for our grandparents, and now that might mean killing them. And so now our ethical lines have become extremely blurred, because if you think about it, we're making choices that God doesn't give us the right to make. This is by R.A. Gallup. He said, once you permit the killing of unborn child, there'll be no stopping. There'll be no age limit. You're setting off a chain reaction that will eventually make you the victim. Your children will kill you because you permitted the killing of their brothers and their sisters. Your children will not want to support you in your old age. Your children will kill you for your homes and your estates. If a doctor will take money for killing innocent in the womb, he will kill you with a needle when paid by your children. This is the terrible nightmare you are creating for the future. And folks, he's telling the truth. Look at what the Proverbs writer wrote in Proverbs chapter 24. He said, deliver those who are drawn towards death. Hold back those stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, surely we did not know this, does not he who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your soul, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds? Folks, we're going to be held accountable for the decisions that we're making, ethically speaking. 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. The Lord looks at the outward, or the man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. You know, folks, just because somebody does not appear what our society has deemed normal, by no means does that mean that's the way that the Lord looks at them. And I'm afraid we have been infected with this idea that they have to live up to this normal standard. Luke chapter 14. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Did he say go out and find the pretty people? Did he say go out and find all of the people who are not handicapped? Folks, we got to start thinking about how we look at individuals. You know, when it comes to these ethical dilemmas, how do we really look at life and the sanctity of life? Because right now, folks, the honest answer is we got more and more people who are moving towards killing, whether it's an unborn or whether it's aged. On the screen behind me, you see a picture of a guy by the name of Jack Kevorkian. His claim to fame? He kills people. And you say, well, Brad, you know, maybe they're suffering. Maybe. Okay, we're going to look at some terms, but I want you to bottom line understand one thing. If something is living, do we have the right to kill it? Has God ever said, I'm going to give you the right to terminate the life of my creation? No. Let's look at a few terms that I hope are going to hopefully bring this home to you and help you in making some decisions of your own. So we'll switch gears. We look at life before birth, and now we're going to swing the pendulum to the other side. What about death? So you get that call in the night that nobody wants. And they tell you that one of your loved ones was in a car wreck and he is now in a coma. You go racing to the hospital. According to Stedman's Medical Dictionary, a coma is a state of profound unconsciousness from which one cannot be roused. In other words, you're crying, you're shaking them, you're wanting them to respond to you, and yet they don't make any action at all. What should a Christian's response be if you show up at a hospital and somebody's in a coma? Please remember this. Number one, coma is a very temporary state. So by that I mean this. Usually a coma happens because maybe your head has hit a windshield. The brain is actually expanding. It bruises just like other tissue. What you've got to do is you've got to wait and see, once the brain shrinks back down, how much physical activity they really do have. So if somebody tells you that your loved one is in a coma, two things. One, we pray to Almighty God, the great physician. Number two, we be patient. Now, from a coma, they can go one of two directions. They can wake up, you can give them kisses and you go home from the hospital, or they transition into what's called a persistent vegetative state. Persistent vegetative state is basically a state in which somebody shows no behavioral evidence of being aware of their self or their environment. This is exactly what Terry Schiavo was in. Those of you who remember that, had a long talk with Terry Schiavo's brother. He came into town and we interviewed him. And we started talking about what all she could and could not do. I was surprised. She was actually a little more responsive than I'd ever heard through the media. And he was showing me pictures and showing me video clips of things that she could do. Long story short, though, persistent vegetative state is when somebody who is in a coma, who did not have sleep cycles, transitions into this where you do have your normal wake and sleep patterns. What do you do if somebody is in a persistent vegetative state? Well, let's ask this simple question. Are they alive? Yeah. Their heart is beating. In fact, Terry Schiavo's heart was probably healthier than some of you in here. Her heart was beating fine. In fact, she didn't even need a ventilator. So what do we do? We basically don't do anything. Because there have been folks who've come out of this perfectly fine. Now, we're going to talk in just a minute about why and that kind of thing, but stick with me for just a minute. What happens if you show up, middle of the night, they look at you, you walk into that hospital room, your loved one is on a machine, and you watch them breathe, but they tell you that your loved one is brain dead. And folks, listen to me very carefully. There has never, in the history of medicine, ever been anyone who has come back from true brain death. Because true brain death is death. By that I mean the brain is shut down, you are flatlined EEG. I don't care what the heart's doing. Your brain is dead. Your soul has left the body. What you're seeing when you see the lungs inflate and deflate is you're seeing them artificially keep that person's blood going so they can harvest the organs if you give the okay. So is it okay for you to walk in and say, you know what, just disconnect everything? Sure, because all they're doing at that point is keeping the tissue in a better shape in case you allow them to harvest the organs. So should you have any guilt conscience at all if somebody comes to you and says, I am so sorry, but your loved one is brain dead? No, because they've already died. True brain death means there's physically no brain activity at all. The problem is, if we back up one, somebody with persistent vegetative state may appear to be brain dead because they're not responsive, but you know what they've still got? When you hook them up to an EEG, guess what they've still got? They got brain activity, meaning somebody's home. Now, the problem in my field in neurology, when we were studying this, the problem is that can vary so much. You may have somebody that has got a massive traumatic injury that only has a little bit of activity left, or you may have somebody that just has a little bit of their frontal cortex that has some damage. And because of that damage, they can't be roused, awakened. The point is this: there's a massive difference between somebody who is clinically brain dead and somebody that still has active brain waves. Let's skip on down since I'm already running short. Somebody's going to need, before, if I ever come back here, we're going to take the clock off the wall in the back. Let me touch on this one just because I know it is a hot topic. What about artificial feeding? Tube feeding. Tube feeding is basically a procedure that provides patients with artificial nutrition from chemically balanced mixture through a tube. A couple of ways they could give this. Let's say that you've got a loved one who is supposed to have surgery, and for whatever reason, their physical health is run down. So you know what they may do? They may ask you, can we put in a feeding tube for a few days to kind of build them back up? Or you may have somebody who is unable to eat, unable to swallow, and so they say, hey, can we put a feeding tube in? And so you've got to make a decision, a surrogate decision as to what you think. That's why we talked on Friday night about it is very important that your loved ones really do know what you want. The bottom line of the whole thing is we got to understand death is not a failure. Because ultimately, death means going home. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, God has appointed a time for every person to die. And as faithful Christians, we shouldn't fear or shun death, should we? I mean, really? So when it comes to these topics that we're talking about, one of the things that I want you to remember is what I call the law of cause and effect. In other words, is the person going to die because of a disease or injury? Are they going to die because of a decision you make? And let me set it up this way. My wife knows that if I'm wrapped around a telephone pole and I'm on, you know, they want to put me on all kinds of machines to keep my body functioning. She knows I don't want that. I want to go home. If she puts me on those machines against my wishes, I've already told her I'm going to come back and haunt her, but that's another topic. If she puts me on those machines, and let's say we get 6 months down the road and she realizes this has become a burden and every day she's having to travel to the hospital. And okay, now what happens if she takes me off? Did I die from my original car wreck or did I die from her decision? See the dilemma, folks? That's why I believe it is very important for us to understand what does our loved one really want? My wife is the total opposite. She's already told me. If she gets wrapped around a telephone pole, she wants me there reading books. She selected music I'm supposed to play to her. I mean, she wants me to go the whole 100 yards. In fact, she's like, you know, you probably better get some battery-powered thing in case the electricity goes off and I'm on these machines. Well, that's her decision, and I'm going to respect that decision. But the point is, if you've got a loved one, and all of a sudden a doctor is facing you saying, hey, we want to put a feeding tube in, you need to know where that loved one stands with that. Because once you put the tube in, if you make the decision to pull it out, what's going to kill them? They're going to die from your decision. They're going to dehydrate and starve to death. They're not going to die from maybe cancer or from whatever. No, it's going to be the dehydration and the starvation that gets them. And you one day are going to have to stand before God and be accountable for that. So as you think about all of these ethical dilemmas that we're talking about this morning, please understand that just because we can do things doesn't mean a Christian has to or should. We've got to value the sanctity of life, period, because we're created in the image and likeness of God, and we've got to make wise decisions, informed decisions, that hopefully will help us to one day step out into eternity and be able to look at God and say, hey, I did things your way. Thank you very much for your attention this morning.